This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security, backed by HM Treasury.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me in the studio is editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss to round up the top stories they've been covering on their award-winning website this week. And the UK's embattled savers faced further pain as official figures showed inflation rose in January.
Most of these accounts are basically either going to be at the rate of inflation by the end of the year or potentially even slightly below in some situations. You're sort of going, it's better to spend the money than to save the money.
And it's expected to go up even further.
I think the rise in inflation could be quite dramatic actually over the next few months, but that will really be driven by higher import prices feeding through to the shops.
It's also not good news for workers as wage growth dipped at the end of the year. Despite employment remaining at record highs, there are question marks over the quality of those jobs.
We don't want to see like people on 0 hours contracts being lumped in with those figures as they are at the moment. It's through security and stability that the economy will get stronger, and that's what really counts.
Well, it seems the rise in inflation is also hitting the high street. Retail figures took a hit this month. It comes as the row over planned changes to business rates continues.
If this is announced in the budget, it will come into effect in April. And I think that is the concern of many of the businesses, that it won't be tapered. It will come in immediately.
Also today, Rachel's been investigating something, well, none of us like to talk about, but it's such an important issue. The loss of a loved one and how it can severely impact our cost of living. But the bereaved have been dealt a further blow by cuts to the government's lifeline. Rachel has more on this. Also, Simon's been tapping away on his laptop. What's it got him going this time? And I'm a little upset this week by something I read on This Is Money. All will be revealed. But we've been talking today about a report by the Institute for Public Policy Research, which says mental well-being needs to be considered with other health issues by employers. It wants firms to almost double statutory sick pay and is recommending chill days for people to recharge and relax. So I want to know, in your opinion, is this a good idea or a bad idea? I'm going to come to you first, Simon. As an editor, your view on chill days. Now, of course, this is a recommendation, so we don't have a full details of this, but I suppose it's sort of in the form of duvet days.
I've always been a bit confused by this concept of duvet days and chill days. I mean, is this a day when you can just randomly not turn up to work?
Yeah, I think so.
So you're not sick, right?
No, it's not a straddling sickness.
And you haven't booked the day off as holiday.
Yeah.
Which obviously requires you to fit around other people and make sure that there's enough people in. But you could just randomly call up in the morning and say, oh, not feeling it, I'm going to hide under my duvet. Which I guess, you know, let's be honest, there's lots of people in the world who we know do that, but they just call in sick. You know, in all walks of life, people will do that. And then there'll be lots of people who, even when they're not feeling great, will drag themselves into the office. So, you know, you're talking about a sliding scale of stuff that the people who would probably benefit the most are the people who do actually drag themselves into the office. And the people who would benefit the least are the people who would probably just swing the leg anyway. But I don't know, it's a difficult one because, like, from the point of view of, yeah, you know, sometimes have an extra day off, a bonus day off. That's great, you know. Who wouldn't want a bonus day off? Unless you're a workaholic. But from the point of view of having to have a team of people in, doing work and getting the stuff that needs to be done done, and it impacting on other people if you're not there, well, you know, if someone's sick, someone's sick. You can't do anything about that. And it's worse to come into the office and make everyone else ill. If someone's on holiday, that's booked in advance and it fits around everyone. And you try to be as flexible as you can. And if someone needs an emergency day off as holiday, then you try to give them an emergency day off as holiday. But as for just sort of randomly not coming in, that does cause all kinds of problems. So from a logistical point of view, I have to say I'm not really pro it. And I think this is an idea that comes from America, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Where they have these personal days, as they talk about. I'm taking a personal day. But then they do that because they get 10 days holiday a year. like most people in this country get, you know, 25, 20 kind of thing. And I think that maybe this is what it's talking about. So,
like,
so you could,
days,
have, you could have them, right? Mm. But then you'd want people to plan them in advance and arrange them and sort it out so that it's not going to impact on the rest of the team and impact on what you're doing, at which point it just becomes an extra day's holiday, doesn't it? So if you're asking, should people have an extra day's holiday? Yes.
Yes, I'd agree with that as well. It's funny, we asked people before we went to on air in the Share Radio studios, and everyone to a man at the and woman at the start said, yeah, great idea. Then the more we thought about it, the less popular the idea became. Rachel, for you?
The times at which you are most stressed tend to be those times when you have a big deadline coming up or something like that. Do you want people to be allowed to not come in on the day that they are most stressed, probably because they have a presentation, they have a meeting, they have a deadline, whatever it is, and other people to have to pick it up? And secondly, this is off the back of research that says that 28% of workers have had panic attacks. To me, the idea of a chill day kind of belittles what seems like a much more systemic problem. Mm. We should be, if this is mental health that we're talking about, then that's something to be taken a lot more seriously than just saying, do you know what, every now, once a year, just stay home and chill out. If we think that such a thing is necessary for serious reasons of stress, then that's something that has to be looked into completely separately.
Absolutely agreed. I think that's a cultural issue as well there. But Simon, I know you like your polls on This Is Money, but we also like a good Twitter poll here as well. So on our Share Radio Twitter account, we've been asking the general public whether they support the ideas of chill days. So producer Joe, what have you got for us?
Yeah, so 58%, Georgie, said that they think this is a good idea.
Okay. 50.
Whereas obviously 42% said no, they're not really backing the idea.
On digital radio across the UK and online, this is Share Radio.
A very good morning. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio and the team from the financial website of the year, This Is Money, are back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NS&I. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss. So, if you're a worker, a saver or a spender, we got some stats this week which won't have made for cheery reading for you. Inflation rose from 1.6 to 1.8%. That's the highest it's been for almost 3 years. Now, while still below the Bank of England's target now, there are predictions it could hit 3% by the end of this year. Here's Samuel Toombs, chief economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics.
I think the rise in inflation could be quite dramatic, actually, over the next few months, but that will really be driven by higher import prices feeding through to the shops. If you try and look at domestically generated inflation in the UK economy, which is really wage growth, I think that will remain very weak over the next year. And so the Bank of England will assume that once this import price shock feeds through, inflation will come back down to the 2% target, and as a result, it won't need to act this year with higher interest rates. We have seen inflation expectations rise quite sharply over the last few months, but if you look back over the last decade or so, pickups in inflation expectations haven't translated into faster wage growth, and there still seems to be some slack in the labour market that will mean that wage growth remains depressed over the medium term. So I think workers really will struggle to seek higher wages from employers over the next year.
Yes, and while unemployment is still at its lowest level since 2005, wage growth dipped at the end of the year and question marks remain about the quality of many of those jobs.
This general set of labour market figures is flat. There was a small rise in the number of people in work, but that was mostly due to self-employment and people on government schemes. The number of, you know, regular employees didn't change at all. And although wages are growing by 2.6%, that's less than was expected. It's actually fallen back a little bit and is now being caught up quite rapidly by price inflation. So the amount of things that people can buy with those pay increases is shrinking. The unemployment rate is flat. You know, the labour markets are stable. But also there are still plenty of people who are looking for work. We've still got over 1.5 million people unemployed, and we've got other people just outside the labour market who might take a job if one were available. The number of migrant workers from the EU is still very high, and that doesn't seem to show any sign of falling since Brexit. It may fall in due course, but it hasn't up to now.
That was director of think tank The Jobs Economist, John Philpott there. So according to economists, workers now face the very real prospect of earning less while having to pay more for everyday goods. Not good, I imagine, for an economy for which consumer spending has been the cornerstone. But where to put your cash as well? And if you can find a savings account paying more than 1.8%, then good luck to you. But firstly, Simon, the inflation figure, slightly less than expected, less still than the Bank of England's target. Should we be concerned by this?
Well, it's difficult to know whether to be concerned or not about something that you know is basically coming and you pretty much know the reason for. And the reason for it is that the pound has fallen substantially since the Brexit vote. And that means that the price of stuff is going to go up because the things that we import are more expensive. So the things that we are just simply importing for us to buy, i.e., you know, that could range from German cars to Spanish lettuces, of which there is a terrible shortage, by the way, panic buying lettuce.
I mean, courgettes,
when I first learned of this and that people were being limited to three iceberg lettuces, I did think, who buys three iceberg lettuces? Have these people not heard of rocket?
Exactly.
Is there a shortage of rocket? Which I discovered there was, so I was very worried. I'm digressing here quite substantially.
Sorry.
But you know who's buying the lettuces? Shops because the restaurants, because apparently the supermarkets are selling them below cost price to consumers, and restaurants are trying to sort of game the system.
So that's why you're limited to three. Well,
that's why you're limited to three. But anyway,
fun fact,
inflation. Yes. Mm. So the Bank of England's inflation report, most recent inflation report, earlier this month, it said the value of sterling remains 18% below its peak in November 2015, which was higher than it was before the Brexit vote, reflecting investors' perceptions that a lower real exchange rate will be required following the UK's withdrawal from the EU. Over the next few years, a consequence of weaker sterling is that the higher imported costs resulting from it will boost consumer prices and cause inflation to overshoot the 2% target. This effect is already becoming evident in the data. CPI inflation rose to 1.6% in December, 1.8% now we know in January, and further substantial increases are very likely over the coming months. In the central projection, conditioned on market yields that are somewhat higher than in November, inflation is expected to increase to 2.8% the first half of 2018 before falling back gradually to 2.4% in 3 years' time. So basically, we have been warned. We have been told. Yeah. The worrying thing will be if inflation and the point at which inflation goes up above wage rises, and that means that people are losing out in what is called real terms, or basically that what that means is adjusted for inflation, your pay is not going up at all. In fact, it's going down.
So is that it, Rachel? Is the era extraordinarily low rates a thing of the past?
I think we're moving out of an era that has kept things okay for the last couple of years. And the fundamentals haven't been great in terms of wage growth, in terms of cost of living, but it's been okay because we've had low rates and inflation has been near zero for a couple of years now. It's all about to change. We are seeing huge leaps now in inflation and are likely to see much more so over the coming months. I think the lettuce case actually is an interesting one, that supermarkets have been selling below cost price. It just goes to show how unwilling they are to put up prices, how price sensitive we are, how happy we are to shop around and get the best deal. And so that will protect us for some time to come. But there will be a point at which they can no longer do that. And what we're seeing are sort of two sets of inflation figures coming out. We see the sort of manufacturing costs, the costs that producers are paying, are going up around 20% now, whereas the consumer price inflation is still below 2%, it's at 1.8%. That's unsustainable. At some point, they're going to have to pass on costs. And we've seen a few retailers have started to do that now. The big names, Sonos was the big one, and Microsoft this week. We had Apple a couple of months ago, but this will become a lot more widespread. I suppose they're able to put up prices more easily because if you're going to buy an Apple computer, you're going to buy an Apple computer, right? But it will become more widespread as other retailers are forced to do the same thing. And then the question of rates. If inflation continues to rise, one of the only tricks really that the Bank of England has to mitigate it is to put rates up. So at what point do they say, maybe this is the time to do it?
And also, Simon, we got this week unemployment figures. Still at lows, 4.8%. Some people were rather pessimistic, as we heard a little bit earlier, about the type of jobs. But what was important is wage growth. That's dipped a little bit. 2.6, so still above inflation. But how long is that going to go on for? And that's surely going to feed in.
Well, if you look at the chart, the average weekly earnings, regular pay, which is put out by the ONS, basically. And this is a slightly different figure to the one that we also get in another survey by the ONS that tells us the annual, the median annual salary. But there's a chart there, and it shows it's indexed down to 100 in January 2000. And if you look at the nominal line, which is basically the line that just reflects the number, it goes up. Pretty much in a straight line all the way. You know, we're doing okay. It's gone up from 100 on the index up to just under 160. And I should say that's just the index number. That's not the actual number in pounds. But there's another line. And the other line is a bit more worrying. And that's the real figure. Mm-hmm. And that is the one that's adjusted for inflation. And what you see is that rises much, much less slowly up towards a level of, I think the peak was 118 in April 2008, and then it sort of drifted lower all the way down to December, well, round about 2013, kind of early 2014. And then it's climbed up again, but it's still below the point where it was in April 2008. And that means that realistically, the average person has less money now than they did in April 2008, which, if my maths is correct, will soon be 9 years ago. Yeah. That is a really, really, really long time to see no real growth in wages. And that is the thing that troubles economists, that troubles the Bank of England, that troubles the government, that troubles the nation. Because, you know, don't forget that there are many things linked to this, including the bit where people hit a big red button marked "I'm angry" and voted for us to leave the EU, which ironically, you know, whatever the merits, politically, economically or not, has now actually caused inflation to go up and is going to continue to make those people who were feeling the squeeze poorer for the next few years. Now, many of them may consider that to be something that is worth enduring to get out of the EU. Many of them may feel that it's not, but that is the cold, hard reality of the situation.
I'm wondering more generally as well, though, Rachel, how this is going to hit the economy. I mean, I said a little bit earlier, this is a very consumer-led economy, is it not? And also, we've seen it, so they're saying, impact already at the high street, with retail sales taking a hit in January, down 0.3% month on month. I know they can fluctuate a little bit, but if you take it over the 3 years, how is this going to materially impact, I mean, crystal ball gazing now, going forward? Are we all going to just tighten our purse strings, not spend at all?
It's not good. We have less money and stuff is more expensive and wage growth is predicted to fall even further, so we'll have even less money. As you say, our economy in any case is driven by consuming, particularly by the service sector. And if people start to cut back, then that will have a significant impact. Then the second thing that could feed in is if we do see rate rises at some point, then people will end up spending more money on the debt that they've accumulated, which is pretty significant right now. And that allows less disposable income, so less money to spend on the types of things that keep the economy going. So it's not great. I'm hesitant to be all doom and gloom just because don't pan out as they're supposed to.
That is true. Yeah.
Most of the time, we see. We have low wage growth, but we also have record high unemployment levels, record low unemployment levels. And so, and that's something that's been puzzling economists for a long time. Similarly, so many predicted that we would see an immediate impact to the economy of the vote to leave the EU. And actually, the Bank of England has now twice had to revise up its GDP, its growth figures, from 0.8%, then 1.4%, and then it just said, actually, no, we're going to be fine, 2%. So you can sort of point to these fundamentals and you can say that according to the rules of economics, we should have less money, people will spend less money, it will cause this decline, that decline, and it will have this impact on wage growth, consumer sentiment and inflation. But you don't know.
No, of course.
So it could still,
absolutely.
For some reason, it could all still be fine.
It could. It's interesting you mentioned about the unemployment figures. You're not as concerned as other people that perhaps some of the jobs that are in there aren't ideal. We're talking 0-hour contracts and the like.
No, sorry. No, I'm really concerned about that one too.
Yeah.
Increasing levels of self-employment, which is fine if that's what people are choosing to do, but it's not necessarily the case. And that's before the other huge fundamental, which may be coming our way, which is automation of jobs. Things are going to change a lot over the next couple of decades.
There is definitely a phenomenon going on where our economy is shifting more towards driving people around in Ubers and delivering food to them on bicycles, which you could potentially question the quality of those jobs, or you could say, well, that's just the world moving on, and you know, we don't need to make things anymore, and there isn't the demand for us to make things anymore or go down mines to find coal and things like that. What we do need to do is deliver hot food to people on bicycles and drive them around in C-class Mercedes. If you are a proponent of the gig economy, this is great because people now have a portfolio career. They can drive people around in an Uber, and when they're not driving people around in an Uber, they can take them some hot food. Mm. If you're worried about this kind of thing, you might think that actually this isn't good, and that where people are losing that regular employment, regular income, regular element of social care that a business brings, where it looks after its employees, that nothing's being put in place to replace that, and that people are being left in an increasingly precarious position. But I have actually seen an example of this in action, which is near me. There is a Deliveroo crew. Basically, along the road, there's lots of restaurants. They mainly run up one side of the road, and then on the other side of the road, there's a little green, and there's a couple of benches. And you go down there any night of the week, but predominantly Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. There's a Deliveroo crew. They hang around out there. They're all the guys who deliver the stuff for the restaurants, and they're just there waiting for the call. Presumably it comes through on their phone. It's an app, and they get notified, and then they go, yep, I'll take that one. But while they're not doing it, there's about 5, 10, 15 at the most of them just hanging around. They've got their bicycles leaning up, sat on the benches, all talking. And it's like, this is what modern-day employment looks like. The Deliveroo crew hanging around.
On park benches.
Waiting for an order.
Mm,
yeah.
Interesting.
It looks a lot like teenagers at a bus stop.
Well,
but except these guys are doing something useful.
And they are. Well, yes. They're giving people hot food, which is what we want nowadays. Okay, look, I want to focus on one more aspect to the inflation, and that is poor old savers, isn't it, Rachel? Just 44 of 669 savings accounts on the market can beat or match inflation. That's according to MoneyFacts. Now, the top five-year bonds pay just 2.05% interest, while the best easy access savings account pay less than 1%. But we're hearing there is hope. More unfamiliar banks have started battling for the top spot in Money Mail's independent Best Buy tables. But while it may be one of London's top tourist destinations, and they do rather wonderful Christmas hampers, is Harrods a serious option for your hard-earned cash? I suppose they do like taking our money, Rachel, after all. What do you make of this?
It's not really fair to say that that will be the lifesaver for savings, who basically, if you have your money now in a savings account, the value of it is being eroded. But the positive side, we do have a bunch of new players in the market. Actually, Harrods has been around for a while, but it's, I suppose, upping its game a little bit. So we've got them. And then a few that lots of people won't have heard of. Oak North, Masthaven, Al Rayan. So they are Hampshire Trust, and particularly when a new bank launches, you can't really be a bank if you don't have anyone's money.
Right.
So they tend to offer pretty good deals initially to get at the top of the Best Buys, so that savers go to them first, choose them over the incumbents. And then when they've got a sort of ample pot, they'll fall lower down. But the upshot for savers is that does mean that there tends to be a bit more competition at the top of the tables, and you can still get a slightly better deal.
Does it mean, and I'll ask you what a slightly better deal actually really means, but does it mean just because we perhaps haven't heard of these particular banks that our money's okay, everything's fine?
So we've got this lovely little protection from the FSCS that says that all of your money in an account up to the value of £85,000 is protected, and that's, you can have pots of 85,000 all over the place, so long as you don't double up on banks that have the same banking license, you do have to be careful. So it's worth checking if it's a name that you haven't heard of, that they are protected by the FSCS, and if they are, then even if they go bust, you're fine.
And what are these fantastic rates that we're seeing?
Good question.
Well, you have a look at this while I ask Simon about something else, because you at This Is Money have also been taking a look at our firm favourite NS&I. After launching a market-leading 2.2%, it's now backtracked, began cutting returns on many of its products, but you at This Is Money still think it's worth sticking with. Why is that, Simon?
Well, because savings rates are so bad, even when someone cuts your savings rate, it may be worth sticking with the person who's cut your savings rate, which is disappointing, really, to say the least. I've noticed a bit of a cull of savings rates going on recently.
Have you?
Yeah, yeah, but another cull, a fresh cull. I've had quite a few letters from my various banks and building societies. I've had one from Nationwide, they're cutting my rate. I've had one from, who else did I have one from? Ooh, Virgin, yeah, they're cutting the rate on my cash ISA. I would have had one from First Direct, but I believe they may have possibly cut rates so far that they would have to take them negative in order to cut them any further. Although I don't care about that because I have an offset mortgage. Yes. So that's the important thing there. I actually don't earn any savings interest, but I don't pay interest on the mortgage instead. Mm-hmm. But what confuses me about this scenario is that the last time I checked, the Bank of England hadn't changed interest rates since August. Do you remember them cutting rates since August?
Not to mine, not mine.
No, I don't. So then I'm looking at the sort of, you know, the yield curve and stuff like that. And what I'm seeing there is that people think interest rates are going to go up a little bit sooner than they previously thought. So I'm a bit puzzled as to why they've started randomly cutting rates in January and February. And it's really rather disappointing. I know that Nationwide, for example, has seen its profits fall and it's seen its net interest margin shrink. However, I mean, it still makes a lot of money. Like, we're talking, I think, nearly £1 billion a year.
Wow.
I mean, could it not afford to maybe just not cut people's savings rates? The problem is, though, if everyone else is cutting savings rates and you don't cut savings rates, everyone puts all their money in your bank or building society, and then you have to pay them more money, and that eats into your profits, and the banks and building societies don't like that. So basically, you got a scenario where, do you remember when you were at school and people used to come up with that excuse, or with your parents, that said, oh yeah, but everyone else was doing it, so I thought I should do it too. It's literally, that is what's going on in the savings market. And it's really disappointing that that is happening at a time when we haven't seen interest rates move in months.
Well, it must have started from somewhere. Someone must have started the domino effect for everyone else too. Or do they all kind of get together? I know they're probably illegal to do this, but get together and go, you know, should we cut it?
Shady space lizards who set our interest rates. Yeah, exactly.
FYI, I was delighted to say my bank, loyal customer of, I won't tell you how long, but it's a long time, 0.01%. I said to them, why do you even bother? Like, why do you bother?
Surely it costs more to process an interest rate of 0.01% than to just write to you and say, we're actually not going
to
pay you any interest anymore.
They didn't even write
you can
to
keep
me.
Your money with us, or you can just do
I
one.
I had to call them up and say, what's going on with this? And they were like, yep, 0.01. Thank you very much for your loyal service, Miss Frost. Okay, so that's it. Rachel, have you found some figures for me?
Yeah, I've been scrounging around trying to find something that beats inflation and totally failed.
Mm-hmm.
Masthaven, 1.25% for 1 year.
1.25?
Yeah.
Well, it's better than 0.01.
That is true.
You're setting the bar high there, aren't you?
The same at Oak North. Harrods pays 1.05%, or on an 18-month, 1.4%. But you do have to have £20,000 to get yourself a Harrods account. But the other thing I wanted to mention was the top comment on the NS&I story is from John Boy in London, who says, I can't seriously believe that any sane person is going to go searching high and low just to get an extra 0.1% interest. This is the other problem, is once interest rates are that low, what's the point? You just give up, you know? They chop another 0.1%, so you're down to 0.1%. What are you going to do, really? Is it much as you hate them? And if we all shopped around a bit more, rates... they may be forced to be a little bit more competitive. we're not going to. You get to the point that it's nearly not worth your time any longer.
So if it's not worth your time, what do you do? Under the mattress stuff? Spend?
Oh, yeah. Spend it. Burn it. Do a KLF. Yeah. Just pile it all up and burn it. Actually, I've found you some savings accounts that beat inflation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You have to lock your money up for 5 years, however. Although, actually, you could just about do it if you lock it up for 3 years. So for 3 years with Charter Savings Bank, you can get 1.85%. Ooh. So you are beating inflation by 0.05%.
For now.
Bearing in mind that that was January's inflation figure and February's inflation figure is predicted to be higher. As we speak, at this very moment, on the 17th of February, you are highly unlikely to be beating inflation with that rate. But for 5 years, Charter Savings Bank again steps into the breach, offering savers 2.16%. Ooh. So if you put your money away for 5 whole years... that would take you to 2022. And didn't that seem like a long way off not so long ago? You can get 2.16% on your savings. And if the Bank of England is right, within a year, you too will be losing money in real terms.
Well, that's all rather depressing, isn't it? Now, I employ perhaps not one of the most recommended saving methods. Now, every Christmas time, I get given all by myself a ceramic pot. You know, the nice, pretty ones, you know, that you have to smash to get your money out. And I chuck in, Rachel's shaking her head there, take a look, they're really quite pretty. Expensive as well. But I chuck in all my loose change, you know, all the pounds and the £2 and all that sort of thing. And so at the end of the year, I smash it and I buy something. And this year I got a laptop. That's how much I'd save. Imagine my horror, my unbelievable horror when taking a look at This Is Money to notice an article about the new pound coins. Now, apparently we need to spend or swap our pound coins by October. That means I have to smash my jar early and buy another one. As I said, this was not the most recommended saving method. It's because the new 12-sided version is rolled out. The old ones are going to be scrapped.
The new pound coin comes out in just 6 weeks' time now. As you say, the current pound coin, you need to get rid of them by October or take them into your bank and swap them for the new pound coin when it does come out. It's going to have 12 sides, going to look very different. And apparently it'll be harder for the baddies and the crooks to counterfeit it.
Oh, that may be true, Share Radio senior analyst Ed Boucher there. But, Simon, sad times for my ceramic pot.
Tragic.
It is.
Truly tragic.
It is.
Good news for the money inside, which will get liberated, of course.
It will do. And then go into another pot.
I'm going to miss the round pound. I quite like the round pound. It's money I've grown up with. I'm old enough to remember the pound note, but now we're going to lose the round pound too. And apparently the new one resembles the old threepenny bit. And I'm not old enough to remember a threepenny bit.
This Is Money, in partnership with NS&I. Have any premium bond prizes you win paid directly into your bank account.
Now, we spoke a little bit earlier about the rise in inflation also hitting the high street, didn't we? Retail figures taking a hit this month, down by 0.3% month on month. According to the Office for National Statistics, rises in food and fuel prices are thought to be behind the fall. Now, it comes as the row over planned changes to business rates continue. 13 of the UK's biggest employers groups have come together to condemn the government's proposals, claiming 500,000 small firms could see a rise of around 300% from April. Sky's Robert Nisbet says the Community Secretary Sajid Javid is accusing them of scaremongering.
Saying that there will be a £3.6 billion transitional relief fund, because if this is announced in the budget, it will come into effect in April. And I think that is the concern of many of the businesses, that it won't be tapered, it will come in immediately.
Mr. Javid also insists the changes will result in thousands of small firms having their rates slashed. But many larger firms, like, let's take Sports Direct, will be better off. Pubs, nurseries, even GP surgeries will be hit with a higher bill. An independent financial expert, Simon Reed, says that's not fair.
Lots of firms are worried about how they will survive after this, because, you know, profits have been cut by the challenges from the online businesses, for starters. Fewer people go into their local stores. You know, so margins really have been cut. It's getting a really dangerous time for small firms. You know, in the last decade or 15 years, we've seen the big giants, the Tesco Metro and M&S, Little M&S, at Sainsbury's, they've all moved in, and they can all afford to offer stuff cheaper. They can all afford to pay more rates and everything else. This poor guy, every day, trying to survive.
Okay, so Simon, Money Mail have a Save Our Shops campaign. What's going on here?
Business rates.
Mm-hmm.
Long been an issue for businesses. This should not come as a surprise. But basically, they're based on the rateable value, the rental value of a commercial property per square metre, and they're calculated by the government's valuation office agency. And what's happening is there's a revaluation. There's meant to be a revaluation every 5 years, but they were last done in 2010 because the 2015 one was delayed by 2 years as everyone tried to work out what on earth we were going to do about the fact that business rates were complained about as one of the main problems for small businesses. So what we've done is we've spent 2 years coming up with something that is going to cause an almighty fuss.
Right.
Well done. So they're going to rise for 510,000 businesses. They're going to stay the same for 420,000 businesses. And what the government keeps telling us is that they're going to fall for 920,000 businesses. Now, the problem is that for the businesses that they're going to go up for, they're going to go up by quite a lot.
And immediately, right?
Yep. Excellent column by Tom Utley in the Daily Mail today. Bemoaning the loss of an age-old tradition of basically going for a drink at lunchtime off the back of this Lloyd's of London ban on people drinking at lunchtime, but also pointing out that his local boozer around the corner from the office, which will be one of our local boozers too, mm-hmm. is looking at its rates going up from £31,000 a year to £42,000 a year, I think.
Wow.
That's a big jump. That's a 30% jump. And if you are running a business... many shops, many pubs, many high street businesses don't make that much money. They don't make a huge profit once they've paid all their costs and everything else. And this is going to hugely eat into those profits. And there are businesses saying that this will be it. We're just going to have to close down. It will become either uneconomical or pointless for them to continue to exist.
Or they'll have to raise prices.
Or they'll have to raise prices. Meanwhile, at the same time, you've got some big chains who, because they're not in... high street premises, which are judged to be worth more in terms of the commercial value of the property. Instead, they're in, you know, big out-of-town units or in warehouses in unpopular areas of town. They're going to actually see theirs drop. I mean, so there was one Berkshire computer shop owner who found out he was going to be charged £450 per square metre, while the nearby Lidl paid only £195. And clearly there is a problem here. You know, the Mail has been leading, has been doing... one of those campaigns that it does really, really, really well, fighting people's corners on this. These businesses are going to lose out and someone needs to do something about it. And at the moment, the government's kind of hiding behind, oh, well, some of these people are going to see it cut and all these things, ignoring the problem. But they can't just keep ignoring the problem. Something's going to have to be done about this, because if this comes in April, it will cause all kinds of problems. And to be perfectly honest, I can't see that happening.
What, it being brought in?
I think something's going to be done about it. This is a disaster. This is a PR disaster for the government. They're basically, they're being highlighted as taking aim at small businesses. And in their defence, they have said that this is cost neutral, that they're not going to earn any more money from business rates. It's just a revaluation. But try telling that to the person running a shop on a high street. Try telling that to the person running a butcher's shop who's going to see all of their profits evaporate. Don't worry, it's cost neutral as a whole. Well, they're going to see their business probably fold.
Just a question, though, about the timing of reports like this. I remember last year we spoke a lot about what might happen to pensions. You know, are they going to be scrapped altogether? And it was about a month before the budget. Is it a lot of people, a lot of vested interests, sort of come out around this time because minds can be changed now ahead of said budget?
Yeah, you get a frantic rush, don't you? Post-January every year, really. I mean, before the run-up to the April budget. I think that is very true, and you get lots of people campaigning, you know, from their point of view and their interests and things. I guess the point is that we should have seen this one coming, because we delayed this revaluation by 2 years anyway, and someone in the government, surely somewhere, should have worked out that this was going to be a problem and done something about it before now.
Editor Simon Lambert. Simon, we're going to just move off this onto another more serious event that can seriously impact your standard of living. And I'm sorry to say that this is the death of a loved one. Every year, thousands of families lose a parent, husband or wife, leaving them, of course, absolutely devastated emotionally, but also often financially. Now, household incomes often drop from 2 to 1, with bereaved parents becoming the sole breadwinners for themselves and their children. Now, in these cases, the government provides a lifeline with payments from the national insurance contributions of the deceased. But the support has been falling by millions every year since 2003. And this is something that Rachel has been looking into. So first, give us more of an idea of the impact of bereavement on people's finances. The emotional cost is obviously the hugest cost, but financially so.
Well, often it's the case that you go from two incomes to one. If you have children, then suddenly you have one breadwinner who also wants to be the person who is at home with their children, who will see an increase in childcare costs should they want to work full-time because there's only one parent at home to look after the children. So it's a huge impact. And we've had these bereavement benefits since forever, paid for out of the national insurance contributions of the deceased. So it's not sort of, you know, a benefit from the general pot. It comes from national insurance contributions. And that has proved, I've spoken to a few widows over the past, a few last year, and this is again, as the topic has come up once again. And it's a lifeline. Lots will have life insurance, and so that will help to pay off the mortgage. But as one told me a couple of weeks ago, that's great, pays off the mortgage, but it does not pay for things like school shoes. It's proven really invaluable. The controversy has arisen because the payments are going through what the government is calling a modernisation. So this involves updating the system so that a lot of the payments that are given are more upfront. So they're to help to pay for the immediate costs incurred by people who are recently bereaved, basically a funeral, things like that, and then fewer payments over the longer term. So at the moment, a bereaved parent, so long as they were married, can claim payments until their youngest child finishes full-time education.
So long as they were married?
So long as they were married, because if you cohabit, you don't get a penny out of the national insurance contributions paid by the deceased. But that is now being curbed to 18 months instead, which the government says is actually good for widows and widowers because it will help them to move on.
Wow, OK, that's what you want the government to tell you when to move on. But, I mean, the DWP say the new bereavement support payment restores fairness to the system, and they argue that the original system was brought in, was it 90 years ago, and they said it was at a time when, and generally it would be, the lady was left alone, couldn't work. And now everybody's working. Well, that's OK then.
I love it when they rubbish what was their system to justify a new one. And yes, it does require some updating. There are some awful things in the old system, like the bereavement payments are cancelled if you remarry or, get this, it's my favourite bit, or if you move in with a new partner.
Ooh.
So that relationship is acknowledged in the payment system when they want to remove them, but they're not acknowledged beforehand. So, yes, there are some modifications that are required, but having spoken to people who feel like they would not have been able to manage in the absence of these payments, then I'm concerned about anyone who is bereaved post-April. The other thing that I find difficult about this is that the government says this is not about cost saving. Absolutely nothing to do with saving money. And yet, I dug up figures. I went through the National Insurance Fund records back to 2002 to see how much we are spending on bereavement payments. And it's been going down very steadily every single year since then. Had we still continued to pay the same amount that we did in 2003, we would have paid out an extra £5.2 billion. And then there are other figures that I've been looking into as well that show that there will be an upfront cost for the first 2 years of £45 million to pay for these changes, after which there'll be a saving, or a net saving, of £26 million every year. Depending on how you look at it, it's a £26 million saving to the taxpayer, or it's £26 million that is not going to families who might need it, who have been recently bereaved.
Simon?
Well, I think that most people like to think that the benefit system should be there as a safety net for people. And the objection that many people have is the perception that for some people in society, the benefit system stopped being a safety net at some point and became a bar to prop themselves up against. And if you go out to work and you work hard every day, to support yourself, your family, etc., then you object to people who don't, you know, who basically just have decided to opt out of the working system, which is a perception that, rightly or wrongly, people have is going on. And to be honest, you know, I know that in reality that does go on because I know people who've done it, you know. But in this instance, I think it would be very difficult to argue that bereavement payments are anything other than a safety net. I'm a parent. I have two children and my wife, and I'm basically from a wealthy family. You know, we earn good money and we both work. It's hard enough getting out to work with two kids when there's two of you earning plenty of money. I can only imagine how difficult it would be getting out to work when there's only one of you and you're earning half as much. And then on top of that, when you're dealing with something as devastating as the death of your partner, your, you know, one of your child's parents, their dad or their mum, you know, the thing that the child needs at that point is as much support and for that surviving parent to be around and there for them as much as possible, because that will affect them for the rest of their life. Take a six-year-old child. If their parent dies, that will affect them for the whole of the rest of their life. And the best way to ensure that it doesn't affect them in a negative way or to minimise the negative impact of that is for the surviving parent to be around, you know, as much as possible, and for them to get the support that they need to do that. And that is why the safety net exists. And yes, I'm sure this will save the government money. And yes, I'm sure there will be people who say, well, we don't have any money. We need to save money where we can. But I think we need to think very carefully about where we try and save money and about when we are pulling away a vital safety net rather than telling people to get their arm up off the bar and just go out to work. Because this is definitely a safety net and not an example where people are just cadging.
And if you are impacted by this, firstly, incredibly sorry for your loss. But Rachel, what can people do? What help is available to people out there?
If you're married, then there is a £2,000, I think it is, pound payment at the moment up front, which is going up to £3,000, after which there are weekly benefits for the first 18 months. This is being extended to more people than before, it should be noted. So it used to be that you had to be over the age of 45 to claim if you didn't have children, and now anyone can claim. And the other thing I would say is get married.
Isn't because, that terrible?
Because otherwise you're really stuck. The government said that it looked into, as part of this modernisation process, it did look into the idea of extending benefits to unmarried couples and their children. But they thought it'd be too complicated, which is strange because they do it in the case of things like child benefit, anything where the parent is still alive, they still have an obligation, a financial obligation towards their children. Both parents do, regardless of marriage status. But then after death, somehow that changes. So to be on the safe side, it doesn't look like this is changing. If you have children together, not a bad idea to get married.
Which leads me on to Simon. How's your will writing session going?
Ah, well, yes. My will is written.
Woo!
And it's all done. It's written, it's signed, it has been sent back
done?
To the solicitors. It was done a couple of months ago, actually. I should have done a proper update on this. I need to write the article about it because, you know, I had some help doing it. And I will update you on it properly. I'll endeavour to get that written and update you on it properly next week and our listeners on the show next week.
Do write it. Was it easy?
Well, once you got it sorted, yeah, it was relatively simple, yeah. But I was going to talk about all the things that I wouldn't have realised and the questions that I wouldn't have asked and all those kind of things and why you can't just do it yourself with a kit from WH Smith's.
OK, well, we've teed it up now. I'm expecting greatness this week from you. Yes, this week, Simon is rolling his eyes at me. Editor Simon Lambert and personal finance editor Rachel Rickard-Strauss, thank you both so much for joining us this morning.
Did you know premium bonds have been around for 60 years? I recently won £100 in the monthly prize draw. I was off to the bank to deposit my prize warrant when my granddad came over. You know you can do all that online nowadays, he chuckled. And he was right. I now manage my premium bonds online. And I've chosen to have my winnings paid straight into my bank account. It's so much faster. You can too by visiting nsandi.com. Premium Bonds, making people smile for 60 years.